You are listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Today we're joined by the advisory board of our International Trade and Competition Unit, made up of world-renowned experts in trade policy, including Sir Lockwood Smith, John Weeks, and Alan Oxley, who join us today, along with our trade unit director, Shankar Singham. Interviewed by the IEA's digital officer, Madeline Grant, they give us a global view of Britain's place in the world and their prognosis of how our negotiations have progressed so far. They examine best practice in a range of different areas, including negotiating tactics, and discuss what an optimal free trade arrangement with the EU would look like. They also lay out some of the potential dangers and obstacles Britain may face in reaching this outcome. Finally, they consider how an independent UK could advance the cause of free trade on the world stage. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.
How we exit the EU will determine the scope of what is possible for future generations, but of course success is by no means guaranteed. What are some of the opportunities available to us?
You're right that this is a pivotal moment. Decisions taken today are going to set the course for generations to come. And the most important thing, I think, is that we ensure that we do everything possible to maximise the opportunities of this moment. Because as we leave the EU, there will be some costs associated with leaving some of the institutions of the European Union, such as the customs union and the single market. But there are huge opportunities out there, but we have to be in a position to grasp them. And to grasp them, we have to have control over our tariff schedules and we have to have regulatory autonomy.
John, what would a good end state to Brexit look like, do you think?
Just to pick up on what Shankar just said, a good end state has to be that Britain has to be in control of its own trade policy. The real problem here, it's a kind of binary situation. If Britain is still part of a customs union or doesn't have regulatory autonomy, it's not going to be able to effectively negotiate trade agreements with other countries. And if it can't do that, frankly, it might as well still stay in the EU, because then it would at least have some say over what EU policies are going to be. But the real issue is you cannot remain part of a customs union. You cannot have a situation in which your regulations are completely aligned with those in the EU. You need regulatory autonomy because you're going to have the flexibility to be able to negotiate tariffs and also negotiate at least some regulatory matters in the context of a modern trade agreement. There's lots of opportunity there for Britain to pursue trade agreements with other countries and a real interest on the part of those countries in doing that. But you have to put yourself first in a situation where you can take advantage of those opportunities.
Alan, any thoughts?
The way in which the community has organised itself, the European community, it now means that Britain is unable to get the full benefit that it can derive from its very significant resources. It's one of the world's leading economies, but unless it moves out, unless it's able to play a wider role in the global economy, for example, to be able to connect with the new spate of agreements which is emerging in Asia, in East Asia, the opportunities to take the benefits of its skills and expertise will be limited. And the European community is heading in the wrong direction. It's not in Britain's interest to stay in that spot.
It's arguable that we've obviously been tied to the EU and it's been determining our regulatory systems and so on since 1973. This has affected the way we think, and I think it's also created an insularity in the debate where we have no clue how the world would perceive Britain and the EU.
Well, I'm surprised every time I come here to not understand why it is that Britain doesn't have a wider picture of what's actually going on in the community itself. From the outside, we see a vibrant economy with very significant growth prospects. It surprises us that it's not better appreciated by the British people themselves.
What I've said in the past is that having been High Commissioner here for 4 years and also a senior New Zealand politician watching the UK from the other side of the world, I just feel that the UK doesn't see itself as we see it. The UK, I think, sees itself as a little part of Europe, if you like. Okay, a significant player in the EU, but we see the UK as the fifth biggest economy in the world. We see the UK as a major, major global player. It's not been able to fulfill that role. We haven't seen a global Britain in the last couple of decades. I mean, I chaired one of the big working groups at the Great Battle for Seattle when the World Trade Organization tried to launch what became the Doha Round. I missed so desperately the voice of the United Kingdom, you know, a major player that could have helped influence the outcome of that major trade meeting. And instead, of course, representing the UK was the EU. I don't want to be unkind to the EU, but they sure as hell weren't helpful. And so to have the UK back on the global stage, to see global Britain emerge again and have the full impact around, positive impact around the world that it could have when the world needs it at the moment. I mean, trade liberalisation has taken a back seat in recent years. Global growth, in fact, is now more rapid than growth in trade, and that is not a recipe for long-term economic gain. We need growth in trade to be leading if we're to sustain global economic growth. And so the UK has now this tremendous opportunity to influence for the better the global economy as we look ahead. There are huge opportunities from leaving the EU customs union because the UK is then in a position to engage economically with the rest of the world in a way that the EU hasn't been able to do. For example, the centre of gravity of global growth has moved to the Asia-Pacific region, and China's a huge part of that. And the EU's been unable to engage effectively with China. The UK will have that opportunity to be able to negotiate a free trade agreement with the United States. I'm sure the United States actually be very interested in that right now. They need to get some wins on the board. And you've got the whole Trans-Pacific Partnership, over about a third of the global economy that the United Kingdom could seek to accede to. That would have the power of bringing the Asia-Pacific and the competitive dynamic of the Asia-Pacific to the doorstep of Europe. And so there are huge opportunities out there to engage with the most dynamic parts of the world today that haven't been available to the UK really as part of the EU. What's critically important is that the end state enables the UK to achieve those trade agreements with the rest of the world, if you like. And it's critically important that decisions made during the Brexit process don't preclude those opportunities that are out there.
It's important that we aim for as much as we can possibly get, because obviously we're not necessarily going to achieve all of these things. But what you do is you build your trade policy around four central pillars, you know, what you can do unilaterally to improve your own tariff position and improve your own domestic regulatory environment, bilateral deals with the US, with the EU, with others, plurilaterally, accession to the TPP, for example, which is a landmark, the most liberalising platform agreement in the world today that covers the fastest growing areas of the world, Asia and North America, Asia Pacific and North America, and then finally, multilaterally in the WTO. Britain could be a huge force in the WTO. And actually, the interesting thing, just to reflect on what Alan was saying, the rest of the world expects Britain to actually be a force particularly in services liberalisation in the WTO, because it's the second biggest exporter of services. The notion that we're a small country that can't, you know, move the needle in the WTO is not borne out by the way others perceive the UK.
Part of the problem is that it's 45 years that Britain's now been inside the EU. So Britons have kind of stopped thinking about the UK's role in trade policy on the international stage. But frankly, I think a lot of other people in the world are looking forward to seeing a new dynamic force on the trade policy scene. Britain can have a lot of influence in terms of the future direction of the WTO, in terms of the future direction of what is incorporated in various trade agreements. This just requires sort of changing the mindset. Right now, everybody's focused on this problem of trying to figure out how you get out of the EU, and that's sapping all the energy. And yet, there's a whole other agenda there that you really need to start thinking about, because this is where the plus side is. And it's a kind of negative, defeatist problem, figuring out how to leave the EU. People need to start grasping and thinking about where you're going next and how you're going to make that successful. And that's going to be important in terms of moving ahead.
I mean, it's all very much up in the air. I was actually at a conference in Brussels recently where I met a Dutch politician who was very disappointed that because of our departure from the EU, because he felt that a truly liberalising force was now departing from the table and making it harder for those liberal voices within the EU. Mm-hmm. Now, I hadn't actually considered it like that. I think we've perhaps forgotten the extent to which Britain may be seen by other countries as a potentially liberalising force. Do you think that's true at a global level?
Yes, Yes, I do. Because Britain has always been on the sort of free market side of things in the debate inside the EU. It's been, and I think if I was in the Netherlands, I'd take a similar view to this person you were talking about. Because for some people, you know, that will be a loss. But frankly, you know, for instance, in the WTO, and I've been ambassador to the WTO and worked in the GATT before that, you know, it's surprising how few countries really have real influence in terms of charting the future course of what's going to happen in that organization. And of course, it's very hard for a member state of the European Union to do that because they don't really speak. The Commission speaks on behalf of them. With the EU having become rather large, we're down to sort of six or seven developed country voices which can actually speak. And suddenly putting an independent UK back into the mix is going to create a very healthy dynamic in which a lot of these new ideas can flow forward.
And there's a major step change occurring in the global economy. Tariffs are quite low now in international trade. Where the growth now is occurring is in the services sector. In the Asian Pacific region, for example, it's understood that prosperity is not going to be achieved there simply by cutting tariffs. What has to happen is that those economies now have to start to provide services and to open up their services markets and to allow for foreign investment. This Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement achieves this. To give you some examples, the earnings from services are considerably higher than earnings from goods. The UK is one of the leading suppliers of services worldwide. So if the UK is restricted by having to stay within the EU frame, its capacity to generate wealth from that sector, and more importantly, provide open markets for other economies, will be impaired and we'll all be losers. So we really do need the UK active in this sphere and leading this new phase of trade liberalisation.
I think this is a really important point about services, because the barriers to services are not like the barriers to goods. The biggest problem in international trade now is those services barriers, those behind-the-border barriers, what we've called anti-competitive market distortions or regulatory distortions. And the ability of the UK, through its independent trade policy, to knock down those barriers, to be able to reduce the level of distortions in other markets that it trades with, and also to improve its own position, to remove the distortions in its own market, that's where the biggest gains are actually going to come. And reduction of border barriers might give you, at best, a 1 or 2 percentage point GDP increase. Reduction of these distortions and behind the border barriers can give you an order of magnitude bigger than that increase. And the OECD has done a lot of studies on this, that lots of people have looked at this, and typically you're talking about as much as 7 or 8% GDP available if you're able to lower your distortions inside the border. This is where the biggest opportunity lies. It's particularly tailor-made for the UK, because it is such a heavily services economy, with 80% of its exports of services. It's the second biggest exporter of services in the world. So there's a huge opportunity for the UK in that area. But to do that, to try to change some of those things and to get that kind of liberalisation in other countries, you are going to have maximum flexibility, which means you're going to have authority over as much all of your regulatory system and your tariff schedules over goods, agriculture. You're going to have to be able to do deals which are comprehensive deals. The notion that we can be in the single market for goods or be in a customs union for goods and then separately negotiate services is not reality. You will need to be able to do all of those things.
And there's something here which is not observed enough. We see it from outside the community. The services markets were supposed to have been opened up with the Maastricht Treaty years ago. It hasn't happened. This is a very significant problem for the EU, because its capacity to deliver significant services within the community itself is denied. It's not in Britain's interest to remain into this system.
Another aspect of this closely related is the growth of the digital economy. And we've had to think about this quite a bit recently in North America, because we're updating the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was completed in 1992, before the internet arrived, before people really had mobile phones, and certainly before smartphones. So the whole world has changed, and the trade agreements are slowly catching up to this phenomenon. But there's still lots of room for developing these new ideas, and I think a country like Britain that's very digitally savvy can make a big contribution to how we move forward in that area. One of the big challenges is going to be bringing the WTO into the digital age. The fact that Britain's been out of the game for 43 years, in some ways you can come back in and there are actually new things that are quite different from what people were grappling with back then. And they're new for everybody, so not just for Britain.
This is one example of, you know, one of the things in the WTO that has been emerged out of the ministerial meeting last year was the plurilateral working group on e-commerce. Now, there's no reason why Britain, when it leaves the EU in March of 2019, should not join that group and should not, in fact, be a big force in that group. But here's another issue that is, to Alan's point about the direction of travel of European regulation and the failure to complete things like its own internal services liberalisation. If you look at the direction of travel of European regulation, it is moving in an ever more anti-competitive and prescriptive direction. And data is a perfect example of this. We've obviously all known
GDPR.
About GDPR, and we've all had to respond to or send out those notices. What the Europeans have recognised with respect to data is they've made a decision about the line between data flow and data privacy. And it's a decision they know, I think, is anti-competitive, and they know is damaging their own businesses and making them less competitive. And so their response to this is not to say, well, let's improve our own regulatory system. Their response is to say, well, if everyone else has to abide by our regulatory system, then there'll be a level playing field. It's interesting they're doing this with GDPR. They're putting data provisions like this in all their trade agreements. Even with something like MiFID II, the extremely onerous financial services
regulation.
How many
paragraphs? Like over a million paragraphs, is that right?
Yes, it's so much data that the government doesn't know how to absorb the data it's been given. The French recently noted that MiFID II makes their financial services industry less competitive, so we need to level the playing field by imposing these same disciplines on the rest of the world. The UK has made itself a global regulatory battleground. I think a lot of countries that believe in competition on the merits as an organising principle, that believe in outcome, effects-based regulation, you know, they need to make sure that the UK adopts a similar principles-based, outcome, effects-based regulatory system based on competition that can be mutually recognised with their systems. That's the way the international trading system is intended to operate. It is not intended to harmonise everyone, because harmonisation tends to be upward harmonisation to the most onerous standard. Problem for the world is that if you do this, all you're going to do is ultimately destroy wealth out of the economy, contract the economy, and that will push people into poverty, and it damages the people at the bottom end of the socioeconomic spectrum the most.
Yes, going to your point about GDPR, there are perfectly legitimate uses of some of this data. So I think it's very worrying that the EU seems to be exporting its approach to the rest of the world. Does this apply to other areas of EU regulation as well?
It applies to almost all of them. I mean, one of the things that we're doing is we're looking at different aspects of European regulation and evaluating the anti-competitive cost of this regulation. I mean, I think if you go back to the 1970s and the 1980s and you look at certain provisions of European law, particularly with respect to competition policy and state aids, one could make an argument that these were actually pro-competitive, these were leading to greater liberalisation. The idea of moving towards a single market, which they haven't done, as Alan said, but the idea of moving towards a single market in, say, financial services, where you eliminate the barriers to each other is a good idea. I mean, that's something that should be encouraged. Problem is, there has been a change in that approach in the EU of late. And obviously, we've seen it in financial services, precautionary principle. We're seeing it in residue regulation that is coming down the pike in the future in agriculture. So the way we used to do food standards is we'd say all our scientists would get together in global bodies like Codex Alimentarius, and we would decide what sound science was telling us was safe or not safe. Understanding that's the regulatory goal, keeping people safe, and this is the science, we would develop our own ways of regulating in those areas, and we would mutually recognise our ways of doing this. What the EU is now doing is essentially saying, well, no, we're going to determine our own food standard, we're going to blow up the codex, and we're going to impose that standard on the rest of the world. Use the size of our market to force companies to do this. And again, if that's the direction of travel of the world, that's going to contract the economy, it's going to push people into poverty, and this is why we have very anemic rates of growth, frankly. We have not succeeded in taking the liberalisation that occurred between 1947 and, let's say, the conclusion of the Uruguay round. In the mid-90s. We've not succeeded in taking that level of liberalisation and continuing it into other areas of the economy. We've essentially stalled at a time when the world desperately needs growth.
There is a related factor as well. With the modern trade agreements, such as has been developed by the Trans-Pacific Partnership framework, countries' partners are encouraged to open their markets for foreign investment. In industrialised countries, about 80% of GDP it contributes to growth, is largely through services. In developing countries, 40 to 60% of GDP only is generated. And this is because the developing countries won't open their markets and are restricted. And as we've said before, today's world is not just trading goods, it's trading services. And unless the developing countries, which is what this Trans-Pacific Partnership seeks to do, are encouraged to open their markets and encouraged to invest, growth won't occur. Now, this is a problem we have which stands out very starkly with the European community. It simply can't and hasn't moved in that direction.
It's utterly vital that we have control of our tariff schedules, we have full regulatory autonomy. What I'm interested in now is, I guess, how do we get to this state? I think the general feeling about the government's strategy so far in negotiations has been very much one of pessimism. If you were advising Theresa May and her team at the moment, what would you recommend?
I think one of the key issues here is the government has to stop fighting with itself. And the Prime Minister has to try to encourage Britons to stop fighting with each other over whether they made the right decision in the referendum. You know, the decision was taken. Parliament has effectively ratified that decision. Now you have to start focusing on the future and how you're going to deal with the new situation rather than continuing to rehash the past. And as long as the debate continues about whether you should be half in or half out of the EU, whether you should be in a customs union, whether the Irish backstop might result in Britain remaining in the customs union in effect indefinitely.
I think there is a lot of misinformation about the customs union. We hear conflicting accounts and there's a very large column of people that are currently fighting to keep us in it. Why would that be so problematic?
I guess I consider myself to be a trade policy expert. But I think, you know, experts tend often to use sort of the jargon of trade policy terminology without really explaining what it is. And while a customs union, we think, oh, everybody knows what a customs union is. In a customs union, you have free trade among all the different members of the union. But you have another feature of the customs union, which is quite different from a free trade area. Because in a customs union, it's one customs territory, and around the outside of that union, of all the countries in it, you have a common tariff. So every member of the customs union has exactly the same tariff. So for instance, the tariff into every member of the EU on automobiles, for instance, is 10%. If the UK would like to negotiate a trade agreement, say, with the United States is obviously going to want to work towards eliminating tariffs between the UK and the United States. But if the UK remains part of a customs union, it is not free to do that because it can't change any of the tariffs. So, for instance, the 10% tariff on automobiles would be a fixed feature unless the UK were to leave the customs union. Well, the United States is already complaining about how unfair the 10% duty on automobiles is. That would be one of its key demands in terms of moving forward with a free trade agreement with Britain. I sometimes think, you know, people say free trade area, customs union, these terms kind of get used, I think, in common parlance, sometimes sort of interchangeably. They're very different. A customs union does not allow any of its members to negotiate tariffs with other countries, whereas a free trade area, each country has still its own different external tariff, but has agreed that as within the free trade area, the tariffs will be eliminated.
I think what people want to see, and obviously there is a value in free circulation of goods. The UK has benefited from free circulation of goods in the customs union. But free circulation does not only come from the tariff structure that John alluded to with respect to the customs union. It also comes from the rules of the single market. So if you genuinely want free circulation, then you must have the customs union and the single market. And if you have the customs union, the single market, to give you free circulation of goods, you're not going to be able to negotiate with anybody else. I think there is a real need for leadership in the country to set out a very clear vision of what the future looks like so that people can run towards that vision as opposed to fighting with each other. And that vision is there's a very, very big gain economically if we are able to lower all these barriers, to do some of the things that people have talked about in terms of acceding to the TPP, moving in the WTO, improving our own regulatory environment, doing a deal with the US. And that's a number. That's a big number. It's a much bigger number, I think orders of magnitude bigger, frankly, than the costs that we will experience that from coming out of the customs union and the single market. And so you have to express that vision, and then you have to give a clear direction of how we're going to get from here to there. This is now negotiating strategy. When you negotiate with the EU, it's incredibly important to have concurrent negotiations going on, to be able to be talking to other people and to be in charge of your destiny as much as you can make it. If you have that concurrent negotiation going on, then the EU will be much, much more compliant. The EU, on the other hand, would like to have the UK in a box, unable to talk to anyone. If we are in a box, unable to talk to anyone, you almost guarantee a bad result.
We need direction. And need a firm indication, a leadership from an outsider. I find it puzzling that the Prime Minister doesn't seem to be leading in such an important step. It's frankly difficult to understand.
To me, what is so critical at the moment, the government must clear up these decisions that seem to be confusing it at the moment to get this clear direction that has been spoken of. They're not difficult decisions because any of the things that are being talked about at the moment, goods in the single market, a partial customs union, a new customs partnership, regulatory alignment with the EU, all of those things, it's got to be understood, if you go down that track, then there's no global Britain. You might as well stay in the EU if you're going to go down that track. So if the vision is a global Britain with a smart global trade strategy with a great future, these decisions are dead simple and they should be made now. So that the focus can then go on negotiating the world's best ever free trade agreement with the EU, doing financial services in a way that lead the world, the digital economy, all these things that the EU does have to deal with themselves, and the UK could help them solve some of these problems. That's where the focus should be, and also negotiating with other partners like New Zealand, Australia, Canada, United States, the Five Eyes partners, if you like, the UK's great allies, and also looking to accede to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But none of that's possible while these decisions keep churning the way they are, where we think the UK's decided to leave the customs union and suddenly it bubbles back up again. You can't keep doing that. These decisions need to be made to provide clarity, and they're such simple decisions because if you don't make them, forget global Britain.
I think we've barely had a chance to even think about global Britain so far because so much of the tussling has been internal. There's been endless fight back from the House of Lords, from MPs in the Commons, and I think the customs union has become a kind of proxy for basically a rerun of the referendum itself. But I think that with the EU withdrawal bill passing through Parliament, hopefully the discussion will move in a more forward-looking direction.
One of your challenges is that for 40 years, the EU has handled the United Kingdom's trade issues, if you like. Its trade agenda has been handled by the EU. And so there is not a great level of understanding. I don't want to be unkind here, but the reality is there's not a hugely high level of understanding among the UK's politicians about what some of these things mean. I think there's not a good understanding of what being in the customs union actually means. Anything that can help build the understanding of the constraints of some of these things, so that it's so obvious they're not wise decisions. Anything that can help build that understanding is helpful.
Yeah. There was this popular joke a few years ago about the journalists would always ask MPs to describe the difference between the debt and the deficit. A staggering number of them would fall at this hurdle and be unable to do it. And I reckon if you applied a similar test until quite recently to what's the difference between the single market and the customs union, we'd find a lot of elected representatives wouldn't be able to answer that question either.
The other issue is because of everything that Lockwood just said, it is even more important that we have a single mind over all of our trade negotiations. There's no country in the world that has two trade negotiators, but we do. We have a negotiator for the EU and we have a negotiator for the rest of the world. And that makes no sense at all. There has to be a single mind on top of everything because everything you do with the EU, you're giving signals as we discuss this with the EU. And those signals are being interpreted by the rest of the world. If the rest of the world believes that the UK is going to end up in some sort of high alignment, you know, locked into the European regulatory orbit, then they're going to say, well, why should we spend resources and effort trying to negotiate something with the UK? Well, obviously, you're not going to be in a position to do all the great things that people here have talked about. Well, these are the sorts of considerations that need to go into every decision, literally every day, that we make with respect to our EU relationship.
We've talked about what a liberalised position could look like and how we might get there. But what are the biggest obstacles that we currently face? We've talked about the customs union, but what are some of the other risks in our future negotiating strategy?
There's a very, very big risk. We have the June Council meeting at the end of this month, and there is a vigorous debate. Obviously, the Irish border has dominated the discussion. The agreement that the UK had with the EU was that as long as sufficient progress is made with respect to the Irish border, we could move into the trade negotiation phase. That was in December. We were supposed to be moving into the trade negotiating phase in December. Now, somehow, we are in a situation where it looks almost like the Irish border has to be absolutely solved. So the EU is changing the goalposts on this discussion. And as a result of this, the UK government is being put under pressure to agree what's called a backstop arrangement, so that if in the event of no free trade agreement, how do you guarantee no hard border in the island of Ireland? And that would be only guaranteeable if the backstop was that the UK would remain in the customs union and the single market for an indefinite period. The UK has made a proposal that suggests broadly similar things. The customs union, single market, for an aspirational period. You know, we would hope that this period would end by December of 2021. Well, again, these are all signals. If the rest of the world thinks that the UK will end up in an arrangement, transitional to start with, but what is transitional now becomes permanent, in the customs union single market, then the UK will be irrelevant to the rest of the world. And the UK will also be irrelevant to the European Union. I mean, this is another point that's important. The EU will have no incentive to negotiate anything with the UK. All the very difficult things the UK is trying to get in terms of mutual recognition, regulatory recognition, what the Chancellor talked about in his Mansion House speech yesterday, all of that will be off the table because the EU will have no incentive to do any of that.
And it seems like pretty basic game theory, actually.
Well, I think what we have to do now, and we are where we are, but what we have to do now is we have to take control of the agenda. And we have so far blindly accepted the EU's so-called negotiating mandate. Simply because the EU has a negotiating mandate doesn't mean that we have to say, well, of course, we have to do exactly what you say. No other country operates that way. And if we had our own negotiating mandate, it would be ignored by the European Union as well. And this is negotiation. So I think the best way to take control of the agenda is to actually say now, look, we are going to put text on the table. Here's the time for speeches and white papers and so forth is over. Here's the text that we're putting on the table. Here's the customs chapter. Here's the Irish border protocol. Here's the regulatory coherence chapter. You consult with your member states and you tell us what's wrong with that approach. Meantime, we retake control of our WTO transition and we start negotiating seriously with other countries like the US and Australia and New Zealand and others in Canada in the context of ultimately acceding to the TPP.
As my old English teacher would have said, it's time to stop planning the essay and time to start writing the thing.
We've been 2 years in the planning. I think
yes.
It's time to get moving.
Yes.
And time is running out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, March 19th of next year, which isn't that far away now, is the date at which Britain ceases to be a member of the EU. It's really quite urgent because there are a lot of things that have to be negotiated in a very short space of time. And the longer this sort of internal debate continues about what exactly do we want, the more complicated it's going to be to engage in negotiations with the EU and then with other partners in a time frame that's going to deliver the needed results. When you put text on the table too, it introduces a whole new dynamic into the negotiation. It's no longer about posturing, you've got specifics. Other member states of the EU will look at the specifics and they'll have to then engage in a discussion about, well, does that particular point make sense or not? And you'll start to see some differences, I think, between other members of the European Union in terms of how the Commission should be approaching the negotiations with the UK. It's a normal part of any negotiating process. But as long as it's still about generalities and the UK hasn't really decided exactly what it wants, you leave the Commission with a free hand for maintaining a united front with the rest of the member states.
And on the flip side, the EU has proven itself very capable of dominating the narrative. You've written previously, Shankar, about how the EU is very good at timing and sequencing in trade negotiations. How would we gain control of the narrative right now?
Well, you have to also understand what their objectives are. So if you look at the EU's political objectives, their revealed preference appears to be that they want us in the customs union and the single market as a rule taker for an indefinite period. If you know that's the case, then they're going to run the clock out on you. They're going to basically use time against you. This timing point that John makes is so important, because if we fall into that trap, we will end up in a situation where we're about to leave March 2019, or we're about to come to the end of the implementation period in December 2020, and we will not be in a position, because we haven't done the negotiations with other people credibly, because we haven't prepared ourselves internally credibly, we will not be in a position to face up to that. So there's a premium here on making decisions, making them quickly. That is going to be, I think, one of the most important things that the Prime Minister and the leadership in the UK government can do. We don't have the luxury of time to have the absolutely perfect arrangement. This is absolutely a case of not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. You just have to get on with it, make decisions. Some of them will be wrong, some of them will be mistakes. But as long as you keep momentum and you keep the thing moving forwards, you'll have a better chance of having a good result.
Yeah, set very clear objectives and stick to them. The really detailed aspects will be worked out as you go through the process.
Yeah, and as you're doing that, you can still make course corrections along the road. You know, I don't think all of us who've been engaged in trade negotiations, we start off with a mandate and a sense of direction. But, you know, after you have the first couple of meetings with your counterparts from your negotiating partner, you realize that you're going to have to make some adjustments or you'll have no agreement. But you can't get to that phase by trying to imagine the whole thing in your head ahead of time. You've got to get started.
There's a particular challenge trying to negotiate with the EU, and that is that it's got a wonderful record of non-completion. So the whole culture of the EU is to sit there and let things roll past and not finish and take it on to something else. This makes for Britain an even tougher challenge fit to set the standard and set the drive lines, because it won't happen in Brussels.
The rest of the world knows that. So if we start giving signals that look like we're falling into the trap of ending up in a transitional arrangement, that the rest of the world will not believe that a transitional period will end. They will calibrate their negotiations accordingly. We're being very Cartesian in our approach to this. We're sort of saying we must know everything. We must know exactly what the end state is going to be, even before we've started to negotiate with the EU. And that is never going to be known, and no plan survives contact with the other side. By adopting that approach, I think we're making some fundamental miscalculations. What this is causing, what this is setting up, is a desperate desire in the business community, in the government, in the parliament, for essentially what are false compromises. And one false compromise is somehow remaining in the customs union for goods and having the ability to negotiate services. It's a false compromise because it doesn't work. Another false compromise is this new customs partnership, the notion that we're not really in a customs union, so we've checked that box, not in customs union. But we've created some mechanism where the UK would be the tariff collector on behalf of the EU, with a rebate that people, importers, would be able to claim if the product stayed in the UK. Never mind how complex this would be for agricultural tariff rate quotas and agricultural import quotas and how you'd administer these things. But the level of complexity and the fact that it would require complete regulatory alignment, and basically it would require single market compliance from the UK side in order to deliver free circulation. So the compromise is, how can we get free circulation and not be in a customs union? Well, it doesn't work. You can't do that. It's not going to happen. You have to accept that there are going to be some costs of customs clearance leaving the customs union, but those costs are not very high.
I think this is an important issue that I sense a fear in among some, especially in the manufacturing area, that if you have to be involved in customs clearance, that this is a huge problem. Now, New Zealand, we're not party to a single customs union anywhere in the world. And yet, one lamb processed in New Zealand can be marketed, that bits from that one lamb can be marketed in any one of 100 different countries around the world. We currently could market that one lamb in 100 different countries around the world, bits of it, crossing customs borders in every one of those countries. Now, we do that with such ease. It's not a huge cost. The documentation around dealing with borders and customs can be turned around with our trusted trader strategies, with our single digital windows. We can turn export documentation around in less than a minute. And I don't think even the EU would beat that. There's this fear of how do you cope with it, with a border, and how do you cope with customs issues is a fear of the unknown. And we need to help the UK see how Canada and the United States handle a border, how Australia and New Zealand, I mean, we've got Australia and New Zealand have the deepest free trade agreement in the world, but it's not a customs union. And actually, it served us very well that it's not a customs union. We deal with these issues every day in a whole range of countries, and the costs are not that huge.
What to you is really at stake over the next couple of years of trade negotiations?
We really are in an unfrozen moment. We've sort of referred to this as an unfrozen moment where things that were stuck and stalled, you know, open up for a bit. They won't open up forever. There's a limited window that we can use. But we truly are in such a moment. The idea of the fifth biggest economy in the world, second biggest exporter of services, suddenly having its own independent trade policy, suddenly being a player on the chessboard after 40, 50 years, is a massive opportunity, not just for Britain and the British people, but for the world. In generations' time, historians of the future will write about the opportunity that we had, and they will write about whether we took advantage of it, or whether we, you know, frankly, were, you know, weighed in the balance and found wanting. And the world desperately needs this. Economically, we've talked about low growth rates, we've talked about the problems in the global economy and so forth. But we also have artificial intelligence and demographic changes that are putting increased pressure on governments, that are putting increased pressure on where are the jobs of the future going to come from. Well, the jobs of the future come from growth. They come from economic growth that spins out new industries and new technologies and innovation. All of this is at risk at the moment. And I think there's just a fantastic opportunity for the UK to play that leadership role that this unfrozen moment has sort of given it. As Lockwood said, it's not that difficult to do. You just have to be clearly in control of your tariff schedules and have regulatory autonomy, and then start the negotiating process.
We've focused on Brexit, which is appropriate for this discussion, but I'd like to note that one of the other things going on now, we're really at a crisis in international trade that's been caused largely by a very strong America First policy from the Trump administration, and which has led to a lot of friction between the United States and, well, just about every other trading country of any significance. And ironically, while it's a crisis, you know, a crisis, a good crisis, you shouldn't let it go to waste. And I think potentially this has actually done some good things already. It's forced a lot of Americans in the business community, in the Congress, elsewhere, to sit back and think, how important is NAFTA for us? How important are these international trade agreements? And Americans have tended to sort of ignore this, you know, sort of it's been background. But actually, they're now being forced to look at it because it's in jeopardy. And they're coming to the conclusion, particularly in the business community, very strongly, that these agreements are important to them. So this is opening up an opportunity, I think, to both look in the coming years, how do we reinforce the integral strength of the international trading system? But at the same time, how do we adapt it to respond to the new challenges of the 21st century? And that hasn't really been done. There have been efforts at that through the TPP, but I think we need a broader effort to do that. And here again is an opportunity for Britain. If you can get out of this circular firing squad syndrome that's going on inside this country and start figuring out how to deal with the rest of the world, you can help be part of the effort to solve these problems that we're facing.
Thank you, John.
At certain points in time, the events occur which suddenly open people's eyes. And of course, the thing which triggered all this was the surge of migrants from the Middle East into Europe. And that's actually what triggered the first response in the UK to say, well, we're actually going to put the barriers up here. We ought to control our own borders. In that context, then the other question emerged, which is the one that we've been focusing on as well. What about doing something about the connections with the European community? And in many ways, John's right, there are certain points in time when the clouds clear and there's an opportunity to do something. And this has certainly been sitting there. I mean, for a long time, we've watched the community from the distance and have always been dismayed at the progressive steps taken, which turned it against its original purpose, which is to create open markets. It's basically been re-regulating. It's closing opportunities for growth. And therefore, I think one of these is a moment of time. Britain has the opportunity, triggered by something else, to suddenly say, well, there is a different world that we can look at. In parallel, we've seen something interesting occur in the Pacific, which was not only with the United States stepping aside with the Trump administration, but suddenly Japan emerging and saying, well, we will be the leader for formulating an area of open markets here. Japan has always been reluctant to stick its nose into these sorts of things, mainly because it's been frightened of being challenged for its agricultural subsidies and its protection of its agricultural sector. But we now have a leader in Japan who's decided to act and lead. And in a way, it's a piece of huge good luck. We expect the United States to be leading on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Japan put up its hand and stepped in its place. It's now created a forum for that. So we've got these two events occurring around about the same time. It's one of these change moments. Mm-hmm. They come about every 25 years, and it's critical to seize the opportunities.
Some might wonder what on earth a bloke called Lockwood Smith from exactly the opposite side of the world is doing here in the United Kingdom, giving a week of my life to work with the, you know, with key players in the UK government on this issue of Brexit. I mean, why am I doing this? And the answer is actually very simple. As has been said, this is a once in a, not just once in a one generation, this is a once in several generations opportunity for the United Kingdom to reassert itself and take greater control of its economic future. The decisions that are being made right now will either facilitate that or block that. And those decisions are just so critically important. I know because New Zealand was faced with a similar set of decisions back when the United Kingdom joined the EU, or Britain joined the EEC in 1973. And we made some bad decisions. And it took a decade for those to really, really bite. And they did bite. And we nearly bankrupted ourselves. I'm desperate to see the United Kingdom not make those kinds of mistakes, because the rest, not just the United Kingdom's future will be blighted if it does, but the rest of the world will suffer too if the UK gets some of this stuff wrong. And that's why I'm here, and that's why I care so much.
Thank you all so much for joining me today.
For more blogs, podcasts, films, and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.